girls right out of high school started talking to us and invited us back to a party. I got in the back seat of a cobalt blue VW Bug with the prettier one, a blonde, and she started making out with me. Such an aggressive young hustler she was, name of Linda. Probably got her culture from nightly TV sitcoms. We arrived at a dumpy split-level suburban house. She led me through the drippy-looking party, filled with shaggy dullards, and took me to the dim basement where there was a naugahyde couch that smelled of damp. She said she trusted me, that I wasn't like all the others. I should hope not, I thought. She didn't seem terribly smart. I felt the space between us. Then she asked if we were going to make love. Yeah, I said, going along with her fast seduction. She pulled her clothes off and we got down to it. We spent a couple of hours together in that dank basement. She had several easy orgasms, at one point stopping to ask me what my sign was. She said, "Oh," when I said I was a Leo, as if that explained everything. I felt sorry for this bland Midwesterner, though she sure was trying hard to liberate herself from being preyed upon by the dumb jocks upstairs. She was taking some initiative. She was doing her own hunting. Still, there was an air of desolation. This sad young stranger. We were from two different worlds. She would probably be trapped in suburbia for the rest of her life, tied down with a litter of brats. I left with promises to call, knowing I wouldn't. Time to leave town. Goodbye, Minneapolis. Hello, Manhattan. NYC, September 1973. I can't believe it. I'm on the 9th floor of 15th Avenue, facing south. Apartment 9H, to be exact. It's a plush hotel suite being used as a Parsons dorm. My new residence. I love it. I have three roommates, curly-haired Tom Fox from Florida, who doesn't yet know that he's gay, but I do, and two Chinese brothers in the next room. The living room picture window looks out on Washington Square Park, and in the distance, the World Trade Center looms like twin phosphorescent robots. I actually live in Greenwich Village, the historic site of generations of madmen, jazz musicians, poets, painters, and revolutionaries, a dream come true. The entrance is on Fifth Avenue, where I'm greeted by an Africano doorman in green livery with gold braid. The lobby is dark wood with huge mahogany pillars. Number 9, I say to the elevator boy, who works the controls. He deposits me in a mirrored hallway. My feet don't make a sound in the carpet. I turn the key and pad into my pad. I park myself in one of the big armchairs facing the windows, light a cig, and begin to write letters, telling everyone of my good fortune. Listening to the Stones' new record, Goat's Head Soup. The single, Angie, leaks out of every 8th Street shoe store and boutique. At night, in my bed, I can hear shots, screams, whoops, air raid sirens. When I awoke, Agnew had resigned, and the Mets were heading to the pennant. Fall movies. Women in Revolt. Une Femme Douce. Pimpernel Smith. The Inheritor, Belmondo. Day for Night, Pal Joey. Machine Gun McCain, Cassavetes. West of Zanzibar, Mary Nolan. Dementia 13, The Petrified Forest. The French Connection, The Damned. England Made Me, The Bride of Frankenstein, My Night at Maud's, La Collection News, Bed and Board. Fall Books. Borstal Boy, Brendan Behan. Teenage Porno Queen, Anonymous. More I Remember More, Joe Brainard. Seventh Heaven, Patti Smith. The Wild Boys, William Burroughs. Exterminator, William Burroughs. The Black Book, Lawrence Durrell. Superstar, Viva. Cherie and the Last of Cherie, Colette. Confessions of Felix Krull, Confidence Man, Thomas Mann. Eric and I check out the new Warhol film, Women in Revolt. Drag Queen Feminists. Candy Darling, Hollywood Lawn, Jackie Curtis, and Real Woman, Jane Forth, whose eyebrows are just two dots. We tie one on after, at a local joint called Shakespeare's. Eric says I will die soon, it's a fact, he says. He also says, I'm very influential, both selfish and generous. He loves Beethoven and Chopin, and is studying to be a concert pianist, but he doesn't know if he's got what it takes, even though he's always been a prodigy. His face turns red when he drinks. It's a Chinese thing. We decide that alcohol is ruining our lives, playing havoc with our self-respect. But the illusion of freedom is so alluring. All seems possible. The joke's on us. Sinking and smiling among the dying bottles. My square roomie is giving me suspicious glances. Thinks maybe I'm a lunatic. But I'm just a punk. I spell B-O-Y. I put up my posters of Uschi Obermeier, the sexy German model in blue jeans and nothing else but her pout. She holds a place of honor in my dreams. It's what you do in college, yeah? Went to see King Crimson last night at the Academy of Music. Bad bridge and tunnel audience, flabby and mustached. I saw Al Kooper there. I'm a big fan of his old band, The Blues Project. He's cool. The band played demonically. For 21st century schizoid man, they trained enormous anti-aircraft spotlights at us. Blinding, terrifying. My mother writes, if you expect us to like you just because you aren't on heroin and not wanted by the police, forget it. Those aren't very high standards. She's right again. There was a nutty girl from North Carolina here last night, drunk on 7 and 7. She got on my desk and acted like an ostrich. Apparently, she goes around NYC spraying Ready Whip on piles of dog shit, then tops it with a cherry. Strange bird. School life. Everyone in my drawing class draws better than me. Gulp. Some days I have life drawing for 6 hours, punctuated by styrofoam cups of coffee and cigarettes. One of our models looks like she posed for Toulouse-Lautrec. Old lady with brilliant henna hair. She's good. Another model is pretty. Young Esther. She's from Dublin. She makes a scruffy Olympia. I'm too impatient. I need more sensitivity to line, mass, and space. I've drawn flat up till now. I'll need to render if I want mood. I want mood. I need more articulation. Teacher asked me if I was stoned when I did my homework. Was I? The Parsons lunchroom is filled with the fashion kids, none of whom eat either. No hippies here. The girls get dolled up every day for school. The different camps cluster, exchanging gossip on the other camps. I usually sit with Suzanne and her chums. She says that when technology zooms to the future, fashion steps backward to nostalgia. There's an exotic student in fashion illustration called Steven Meisel, who looks like Rudolph Valentino with long hair. Very mysterious. There's a busty nympho named Daisy, who never stops talking about sex. Parsons girls love dick, she says. Later. I see I'm going to have to educate you. Why don't you eat me, honey? Which is meant to make me blush, I think. She's just talking soda pop. Says she wants someone to fill her with milkshakes tonight. Her older illustrator boyfriend painted her for Playboy. She's got a real 1950s cheesecake figure. I spotted one of my favorite artists, Larry Rivers, across the Parsons Lounge. So I go up and talk to him. He teaches here. Doesn't show up much. Sends his assistant around instead. But it looks good on the Parsons faculty roster. He resembles a hawk, with a hawk-like gaze as well. Deep, velvety voice. He was wearing construction boots that were spray-painted copper. We talk about his friend, David Hockney, who's going from strength to strength. 1/5. Sopwith Camel are staying in this hotel, one of my favorite San Francisco groups. They open at the Bitter End tonight. Saw them out on the sidewalk with their guitar cases. Then I spied a pretty black-haired girl with super red lips and bright green shoes. It's Jane Forth, Warhol superstar. I paced around trying to look inconspicuous. She spotted me, so I made a beeline to Eli Weiland's 8th Street bookshop to get lost in the shelves. Then crossed the street to Discophile, the cool import record shop that's always got the latest. I love the atmosphere of record shops. One of my all-time favorite pastimes is flipping through record albums. I'm in love with love. I'd like a life of first loves. First comes curiosity, then exhilaration, then passion, then friendship, then maybe disillusion, disenchantment, the drug of female illusion. It's complicated. Art. I'm trying to find my own visual language from my mind's warped filing cabinet. Points of reference. If someone expects me to be good, I'll be better, better than I have to be. That's the plan, anyway. I currently like Paul Wunderlich, a German artist with erotic overtones. NYC. I heard that in Manhattan, you can hire a guy to kill someone for $60. New York City is dirty and broke. I'm dirty and broke, too. I walk and walk and walk, getting my bearings, riding the crest of crowds. A balmy Florida wind is blowing me through the myriad of faces. I feel radiant. Been here 2 weeks now, wandered around Midtown, the cool marble of St. Patrick's Cathedral. I'd love to hear Booker T. on that pipe organ. I had a $3.50 chili dog and Coke in the auto pub in the GM building. Sat in a Formula One race car seat and watched a simulated movie of a Grand Prix on the screen in front of me. Very Clockwork Orange. Strolling past Tiffany's, Bergdorf's, Bendel's, F.A.O. Schwartz, Fidel Sassoon, Louis Jordan, Cartier, and Rizzoli, where a new Egon Schiele book costs $125. But I want it. My allowance won't cover that. Too bad the rich don't know how to spend their money. Oh, what I could do with it. My Chinese roommates had a noisy party. They danced to 8 days a week. I was in the bathroom inspecting my new shipment of crabs. The Chinese shout, "Chow Hai," which they say means "stinky cunt." A drunk preppy girl wore a pink sweater. I'm a sucker for pink sweaters. And her brown buttons became aroused. And she simulated jacking off on my leg, part of being drunk. My roommate says, "Donut, you look funny tonight. You gay boy?" And then bursts into hysterical laughter. He loves American soul music. The Spinners, Four Tops, Temptations, Supremes, LaBelle, Jackson 5, OJs, and the very moving Al Green. I'm nervous. Jenny Brown is supposed to come visit me from Bard. Every knock on the door sends my heart to my mouth. I'm still carrying a torch for her, even though she took my heart and stomped that sucker flat. She's a dream wrecker. Instead of Jenny, it's ace guitarist Rob Dupre at the door, in brand new Beatle boots, holding a bottle of orange soda pop. He tells me, Jenny's not coming. She's too in love with my rival. Dupre's with his sulky girlfriend, Cheryl, who's jealous because he and I have lots to talk about and enjoy each other's company so much. We walk down to Washington Square Park, and they say goodbye, leaving me to mull over my dashed romantic hopes alone. I shared an ice cream with downstairs neighbor Regis Ingrid Redden. She's got beautiful everything, curly blonde hair, flawless skin, etc. Actually, looks like young Ingrid Bergman. Queen of Cups in her peasant shirt. She should be painted by Lord Leighton. Maybe she was. She strikes me as a mama's girl, quite sensible, lacking the frisson of lunacy that typically engages me. I'd still like to pluck at her angel feathers. Fall Records. These Foolish Things, Brian Ferry, Todd Rundgren, See My Baby Jive, Wizard, My Funny Valentine, Miles Davis, Berlin, Lou Reed, Pinups, David Bowie, Quadrophenia, The Who, Gene Vincent's Greatest Hits, Tubular Bells, Mike Oldfield, Mind Games, John Lennon, At the Scene, The Dave Clark Five, Edith Piaf's Greatest Hits, 10cc, David Essex, Jerry and the Pacemakers' Greatest Hits, Soft Machine 7. Eric Lee asked me why I'm so romantic. I don't know. How do you define romantic? Marveling over something simple. Interesting. That's like being an artist as well. Putting on the rose-colored glasses. October 15th, 1973. School. I'm taking two illustration courses, two painting, two drawing, one printmaking, one photography, 24 hours a week. I did a soft ground etching called My Holiday in Egypt. Weekend at Bard. Dressed in silk, velvet, and leather, Eric and I board the Amtrak train for Rhinecliff, a couple of glam rockers spending the weekend in the country. Bit of the old alma mater with the promise of a conjugal reunion with Medusa the Seducer, Jenny Brown. Step off the silver tube into the steaming station. A posse of old pals from last year took us straight to the bar, where numerous rum 151 and cokes were downed. Bratty Jenny was there. Said I could stay in her room, but not with her. Still giving me the old bum's rush. Eric got picked up by a co-ed named Laura, who was rumored to have worked in a massage parlor, so his lodgings were sorted. A couple of drunken days later, after staggering around in the woods, play-acting French gangsters at a reception at Haunted Blythewood, with sherry being served by young girls in white aprons, and just generally being degenerates, Eric gave me a pep talk about Jenny, how I was handling her all wrong, from a position of weakness, rather than strength. How it pained him to see me lacerating myself with her rejection. He gave me some tough love. Start acting strong. Just try it. What have you got to lose? Who do you like? Alain Delon. Well, use it. Let it show. So, I got my chance, sitting in the bar ignoring her. Witness this scene, transcribed verbatim. JB. Well, what's the matter now? You're mad, I suppose. DH. Gazing off into the middle distance, allowing a stream of blue smoke to escape from nostrils. No, why should I be? Sipping at my bourbon. JB. Begins to get interested. You are so incredibly handsome. D.H. Hmm. J.B. I don't think I've ever seen you look quite so handsome as this evening.
Ha ha ha!
D.H. laughs. J.B. Let me loosen your tie. You'll suffocate in here. While she's doing that, D.H. stares at her with no expression. It's an illusion. Inside, he is feverishly thinking about Eric's advice, which is actually working. J.B. You're too much competition for me. When I'm with you, no one notices me. Plus, I've got to get my artwork up to a higher standard before I start hanging around with you. D.H. That's shit, and you know it. J.B. Surprised at this assertion of authority, widening her eyes and lowering her voice. Dunk, you know I'm in love with you. D.H. That's good. J.B. I always have been. D.H. Sure. J.B. Exasperated that D.H. isn't gooing and gawing over this, surrenders in anger. Okay, I never planned on telling you this, but here it is. I've been obsessed with you ever since I first met you. 4 years ago, I've never been so in love with anyone in my whole life, and I never will be again. D.H., nonplussed, calmly. I don't believe it. When did we meet, anyhow? J.B., see? You don't even remember. It was the school prom. You were playing drums, and all the girls were enraptured. I loved you the minute I saw you. I would have given up anything for you. D.H. Yeah, I remember that night. The band and the audience were all on acid. Kramer quit because he couldn't hear his piano. Clifford quit because he could see the notes coming out of his bass. Brooks was frustrated with what he was playing, so after a brief Jimmy Page parody, he threw his guitar down in disgust. That left me to do some kind of Motown drum solo. What a horrible night. When we were introduced, I said, "How are you tonight?" And you scowled at me and said, "What do you mean by that?" So I figured you were one of those sensitivity training, encounter group, analytical bullshit people. J.B. We'll see. That's why I'm like this. I'm flipped out that you even like me. I can't understand why you do. I can't handle it. D.H. Is any of this true, or are you making it up? J.B. Desperately. It's true, I swear to God. 4 fucking years. That's why I got so upset when you fucked Lucy, my own best friend. I wanted you for myself. D.H. But Jenny, you threw her at me. You orchestrated the whole thing. J.B. I can't help it. I'm crazy that way. I push you away because I can't afford to lose you. I was shocked that Eric's stage directions paid off. Now that Jenny was softened up, my indifference slowly vanished, and with it, the hold I had over her. I lost my cool. As I reverted to my affectionate self, Jenny was back in her protective, snotty shell. It was a catch-22. Can't win. Ironically, the jukebox was playing The Love I Lost. October 21st. Saw the Dolls on TV. Local heroes make good. Art school romance? Somehow my friendship with the stunning Regis Redden turned intimate. It started when she took me out in the town. Serendipity for caviar, then Truffaut's Day for Night, then a drink at the auto pub. Her face is as readable as a book, but it's a confusing book. I can see her brain making decisions. Equal parts Liv Ullmann and Shirley Temple. We're mismatched. But how do you keep a friendly distance? I'm not good at it. Are girls magic? Asked Jean-Pierre Léo. One might well ask. A Cinematic Reverie. Dear Diary, Regis sends me notes in my inbox at school. Heart-shaped chocolates. She came down from upstairs, voluptuous in her nightie and robe, and we smoked some pot and watched Pal Joey. She says, I'm schizophrenic. She's not the first to suggest that. And says she's confused by me. I don't blame her. I'm liking Kim Novak tonight. Who's the mouse, says Sinatra. What do I care for a dame? Sinatra is such a jerk. Hangovers run in my family. Friday I spent in the school darkroom, developing new black-and-white photographs, pretending I'm David Hemmings. 8 hours of inhaling those chemical fumes. My teacher's interested in these 8x10s of my wild friends, but he cautions me to see and not to worry about making pictures. Eric Lee came to my digs around 7. We had some drinks in preparation for the Big Parsons masquerade party. We went over to the girls' dorm to pick up the hard-drinking Detroit girls. Pretty Shelley Dunn, dressed as the Goldfinger girl, the girl with the Midas touch, but don't touch too much. And her roomie, Carol, dressed as a stripper with gaily colored balloons applied to her tits. In the lobby was Todd Rundgren, sitting on the couch, legs crossed, waiting for his date, I guess. Eric and I asked him if he wanted to start a band with us. He paused, scrutinized us, and said, no, in a decidedly non-cryptic manner. We floated up Fifth Avenue and up the elevator to the party. I was tap dancer Tommy Toon, in gold satin suit and spectator shoes. Eric was his hero, Lao Tzu. There were nuns, a pregnant girl, a mummy's daughter, Imhotep, Daisy, with a giant pink satin cock, a 7-foot-tall Chiquita banana, Dracula, of course, the children of the damned, a naked skinhead painted white, and various Martians. A proper art school ball. We drank, we danced. We got a cab up to Radio City Music Hall for a midnight show by England's own Mott the Hoople, who roared through their hits. Raucous audience, great fun. My mother is arriving at Kennedy Airport in 2 hours, and I'm stoned out of my mind. She thinks I'm nuts anyway. Teach me to disguise. I paid my 35 cents to go uptown to see her. She was staying with her fancy friend Peggy Hawkins in the United Nations Tower. Peggy's very condescending to her. Mom was drunk and babbling a mile a minute, dressed in one of her homemade Chanel suits. She makes her own clothes based on what Audrey Hepburn is wearing lately. Peggy smiled at her arrogant ad man husband as if to say, Bunny is sweet, but not too much up here. I felt embarrassed for her. October 31st. The New York Dolls are hosting a Halloween party at the ballroom of the Waldorf Astoria. The pomp and gilded splendor of the fabulous hotel was a surreal contrast to the gathering hordes of glittering rock kids parading up the carpeted stairs, holding onto the handrails for dear life, lest they fall off their elevator shoes. They'd been working on their costumes for weeks. There was Zachary, Satan, the Jolly Green Giant, phantoms, she-creatures, faux Hollywood starlets, and short little Eric Emerson, the wandering minstrel. Todd Rundgren was jerking his girlfriend along by a leash. He said to her, "Come on, Elmer." Rodney Bingham-Hymer stood around looking dumb. David Johansen looked elegant, in white satin tails and silver top hat, ever the showman. Syl Sylvain asks on stage, "How's she dance?" "Close. Very, very close," responds David, rolling his eyes. Dupre and I are wandering in the lobby. I'm in my Mr. Freedom black velvet overalls, with no shirt, displaying a lot of skin. A guy in a fatigue jacket says in a New York sing-song drawl, "What are you, a movie star?" No, just an art student. Well, you should be a movie star. What's your name? I ask, figuring him to be a dozen or so years older than me. Danny Fields. My mind raced. I knew that name. From Elektra album covers. Hold on, I got it. The Doors, the Stooges, the Velvets, the MC5? Fat Danny Fields? Mm-hmm, he said lazily. You get high marks. Very pleased to meet you. I'm Duncan Hanna, and this is my pal Rob Dupre. He introduces us around to magazine editor Lisa Robinson, Roxine, Lee Black Childers, Bowie photographer, Wayne County, drag rocker, Steve Paul, The Scene, Blue Sky Records, Lenny Kay, Nuggets, Sarinda Fox, etc. Danny asked us over to his place on 20th Street after the show to smoke some hash. We accepted readily, filled with questions for this behind-the-scenes tastemaker. Down at his dark mini-loft, we got so high we could barely finish our sentences, but asked about our favorite rock musicians. What's he like? What's he like? Danny answered every question the same way. He's an asshole. Finally, I said, wait, you said that about everyone we asked about. All rock musicians are assholes. It's okay. I love them, too. It's just the way it is. That was our first lesson. There's a big photo of Naked Iggy on the wall by Gerard Malanga, with a big dick, as one would imagine. Iggy acts like a guy with a big dick. Danny's got loads of taped telephone conversations with everyone from Jim Morrison to Pete Townsend. We smoke some cigarettes and Danny serves brandy. Then he finally kicks us out. Dupre and I walk down Fifth Avenue, thrilled with our good luck to have befriended this New York City legend. I suspected we had just walked through the looking glass. That Jezebel Jenny Brown is down for a visit. We go to Enrico and Paglieri, an Italian joint on 10th Street, where you can have spaghetti, garlic bread, and all the red wine you can drink for $10. We take advantage of that and consume countless carafes of Planck. She says, you're good at something, but I'm not sure what. Her new saying is, it's a pain in the eye. We get in a fight. She screams, I don't want to live in a French movie. She sleeps over, but is unresponsive. Then I wake, and she's sucked me to a stand, but she still wouldn't fuck. We listen to the incredibly sad soundtrack to The Garden of the Finzi Contini. It is not happening. We go back to sleep. Wake up a third time. This time, our bodies did come together in a coital manner. But it wasn't like before. Jenny held back. It was a mercy fuck, a one-sided affair. Meanwhile, Danny Fields has been very attentive. He invites me over. He went to Harvard. He works for 16 Magazine and Datebook. We talk about the Dolls Night, where I'd met so many of his hip underground friends. It was a spectacular debut, and you handled it well. You have a quality about you that the rest of the mimps, as he calls us, don't have, he says. Everyone's been calling me to ask who is that star with all the people following him. This is Danny's stock and trade, discovering beauty and talent. I realize that I will be relegated to the position of dumb blonde, but hey, let's see where this leads. He says, perhaps one day you'll make me cry. He takes me up to a Times Square gay disco, Le Jardin, where Patti Smith is giving a performance in honor of Arthur Rimbaud's birthday. Palm tree decor bathed in blue light. We sit in front just below her, and Danny's taking photos with his fancy Nikon. Patti is wearing tight black silk pants and an old white T-shirt that says Performance on it, with cross checker flags. Her Keith Richards shag. Lenny Kay joins her for some simple electric guitar backup. a red Gibson Melody Maker, and his black-framed glasses. Patty jokes and ad-libs, talking in her Jersey accent about how this is her way to ally herself to her heroes, Piaf, Moreau, Pallenberg, Hendrix, Morrison, etc. Their works, their faces, their voices. I can relate. Poetry meets pop. They do the Marvelettes. The hunter gets captured by the game. Danny introduces me after the set. Patty says, "I like your sneakers. You're so beautiful." "So are you," I reply, blushing. She giggles. Danny gives me his rolls of Tri-X to develop at the Parsons Dark Rooms. Lee Childers asked me to go to Reno Sweeney on West 13th Street the following night to see Holly Woodlawn's debut. He's with Jamie Andrews and Tony Zanetta, refugees from Warhol's factory, plus Lee's roommate, Wayne County. They work for Main Man, Bowie's management company. They're on an expense account. Champagne, ringside table, limousine waiting outside, all on Bowie's dime. There's publicist Susan Blunt, Dory Previn, Tommy Toon, Yoko Ono, Rex Reed, Tammy Grimes, Robert Mapplethorpe. I get the feeling from this society that New York takes care of its own, that all these eccentric characters have found a niche no other city would have provided for them. In the limo, Wayne takes hold of my exposed inner arm, gazes at it, and says, "Oh, you'd make such a beautiful junkie." Lee says, "Just leave his arm alone." Lee drops me at the 1/5 awning, a gallant southern gent in a white double-breasted suit. I feel like Dorian Gray being squired around by these older homosexual men. So far, there have been no passes made, nor have I been made to feel like I owe anybody anything. I go over to Danny's. He says, "Look through my records, 3,000 of them, and see if there's anything you want. Promise me you'll never buy another record again." We smoke hash, snort coke, and drink cognac. Watch the petrified forest. He calls me Super Tot, or the Tot of the town. I leaf through his clippings, his copies of German magazine Twen. He tells me stories about Tim Buckley. Fred Sonic Smith drops by, a survivor of the crazed MC5. I'm surprised at what a Neanderthal man he is. Very primitive indeed. Very literal, no sense of irony, which is essential for humor. I'm impressed by the respect that everyone shows Danny. Everyone. He's always on the phone, gossiping with his pals. Candy Darling is dying, and everyone knows it but her. They do a recap of every night's activities, every showcase, press party, Max's, Ratner's, the all-night Jewish deli on 2nd Avenue that caters to drag queens, etc. I tell him about my heart palpitations, and he says, "Poor baby, let me send you to a heart specialist." He also said he'd buy me a gray novelty tweed suit from a West Village boutique that seemed like the one Bowie wears in the back of pinups. Steve, looking for the magic, Paul, and chauffeur David Newman, pick me and Danny up and take us to the Philharmonic for Ray Bolger's Salute to the Broadway Musical, a review of reviews starring Hermione Gingold, Beatrice Lilly, Gwen Verdon, Tommy Toon, and Fred Astaire himself, big ears and all. Afterwards, Max's, where Alice Cooper and the Dolls hold court in the corner booth. I ordered the Surf and Turf because it's on Steve's tab. Groupies table hopping with their tits hanging out. Outrageous flirting going on. A smattering of male hustlers, tailor-made. We sat with theater critic Donald Lyons, who looks like Terry Thomas. We talked about Clementi, Delon, and Sonda. I smell like booze all the time now, but it's expensive booze for a change. Perpetual hangover. I never seem to have a spare second to write anymore. I'm living faster than I can write. Now that I actually have something to write about, there's no time to do it. I only sleep about 4 hours a night. Strangely enough, I'm getting all A's in art school. Did a painting of Clementi from The Conformist. Danny showed me an advance copy of the December 6th Rolling Stone. On the Society page, in an article by Lisa Robinson about Patti Smith, it said, "Among those who gave her a standing ovation was Duncan Rathbone Hanna. Something to send my parents to show them that I'm doing well. My life is an inexplicable mystery to them. Danny turned 32, so I gave him a drawing of a shaggy youth. We went to a press party upstairs at Max's for a new English band called Blue on the RSO label. Talked to Marty Thaw, Doll's manager, Garland Jeffries, who fucked my old girlfriend Lainey, Patti Smith, Robert Stigwood, Terry Ork from the bookshop Cinemabilia, Stephen Gaines, Circus Magazine, Lenny Kaye, Little Boy Blue Steve Paul, the albino Winter Brothers manager, and scribe Lisa Robinson. All of us soaking up the free drinks. Record companies throw good parties. Then Danny and I cabbed uptown to see the French Connection. Sandwich at the Stage Deli, French cigarettes, then back to Danny's to watch Funny Face at 1 a.m. with Steve Paul and his hashish. We sang along with the lyrics. Steve was shocked I was so well-versed in Gershwin. I grew up with the soundtrack playing in the family hi-fi, my parents' favorite. I kept freshening my drink in the kitchen and finally passed out. Danny woke me in the morning, saying, "Duncan, don't be alarmed. You're at Danny Fields." I doused myself with lemon water and Lavoris, trying to extinguish the smell of alcohol that permeated my body. Walked 7 blocks down Fifth Avenue to school, where I dutifully drew for 3 hours. The model gets me horny as I stare into her eyes. She's dressed up like Vampirella with her yaya exposed. I take extra special care getting her nipples just right, and the delicate arrangement of her cunt. Finally, I can leave. Back in my dorm, Regis comes up to photograph me. She's been trying not to like me. She disapproves of my new lifestyle. Says she doesn't get it. What's the appeal? I putter about my room, not having been home in a couple of days. Despite the rack and ruin of my nocturnal habits, the photos came out showing an innocent, with a mischievous smile. Weird. It is like Dorian Gray. Went up to the Guggenheim to see a big Richard Hamilton show. I love his use of collage with painterly bits. The Vogue cover series was particularly good. He was Brian Ferry's art teacher. Then on to Hundertwasser, whose primary colors make me feel very dull indeed. An exquisite Hockney print show. De Kooning's and Diebenkorn's at the Met. A nourishing afternoon looking at real art, raising the bar high. The more I work, the more I understand and enjoy others' work. It's one of the benefits of being an artist. It gives you a kind of visual access. I know what they're doing, what they're thinking, what they're feeling. I'm not nearly there myself, but at least it's in motion. I went up to Danny's, brought him my last journal to read, at his request. I sat in the living room looking through his archives. Letters from Nico, photographs, postcards, fanzines for aspiring stoogelings. Popped. Everything you want to know about the boys from Ann Arbor. A stack of French teen magazines called Copain, with lots of color pics of Delon. I was listening to Syd Barrett. Meanwhile, I could hear Danny laughing in the other room. Danny said he was amazed at my journal for a number of reasons. Surprised to see how much was on my mind. Surprised to see what a heterosexual I was. He said it was very modern, the highest compliment he could pay anything. I asked if he thought I sounded shrewd and calculating. He burst out laughing. "What's so funny?" I asked, bewildered. "I'm sorry, it's just that I never read anything quite so uncalculating or unshrewd." "It's touched with genius," he said. Well, he is the editor of 16, so a diary by a pretty debauched rock kid would be right up his alley. I take his praise with more than a grain of salt. The phone rang. I answered it, saying, "Danny Fields residence, Duncan speaking. How may I help you?" Danny got on with his jaded gay accent and said, "I'm just reading Duncan's diary. It's incredible. The kid has talent. The sex scenes are vivid. It's so cute." We walk over to Max's about 1 a.m. Danny takes his usual booth in the back room with the gray carpet on the walls and the Dan Flavin neon sculpture burning in the corner. Danny dons his dark glasses and broods over his Remy. Fran Lebowitz sits with us and complains about her latest trick. Dolls drummer Jerry Nolan comes in with a gaudy chick in leopard skin, zippers, and frosted hair. Real skanky. Fran slips off. Then Danny shouts, "Lewis! Lewis! Come join us!" Looking at the entrance to the back room, I crane my neck to see who he is talking to. Gulp. Standing there in an alcoholic stupor, looking into my eyes, is the avatar of decadence and perversion, the legendary Lou Reed. Looking thin in a gold leather jacket and denim trousers, he seems confused, thinking I'm the one yelling, "Lewis! Lewis!" even though my lips aren't moving. He walks over to me in a daze, finally looks across from me, then his face breaks into recognition. "Danny Fields!" he says with a crooked smile. He sits down, and Danny introduced me, using my full name. Lou asked where I'm from. "Minneapolis." "I was there," he said matter-of-factly. He's talking very slowly and thickly about how he wants to kick Lester Bang's balls in, how everyone should shoot speed, about his last encounter with Nico in Paris, how she was completely off the wall, how her filmmaker boyfriend broke pieces of furniture over an interviewer's head while Nico kept babbling on in her deep German voice, oblivious. How the MC5 drummer Dennis Thompson told Lou he needed some Motor City Impact, and he was Lou's man. About seeing Faye Dunaway and Peter Wolfe necking in a corner of the Chateau Marmont while Lou was talking to Iggy and Sable Starr. Lou said Patti Smith amounted to nothing more than a haircut. He ordered 2 double tequilas at a time and ended every sentence with, "as it were." Eric Emerson strolled over in silver hot pants, strumming his beat-up acoustic guitar, and serenaded us with a new song that was dedicated to Lou. I thought it was pretty good, but evidently I was in the minority. Then Lou turned his jaundiced eye to me. When I told him I lived in 1/5, he related how he'd been to a party there, and some drag queen was trying to get Lou to notice him, so he hung out the window by his hands and finally dropped to his death. It made all the headlines. Lou shrugged. I was trying to think of what to say to Lou, my hero, when what should come on the jukebox but "Walk on the Wild Side." I asked him to doop-de-doop along with the doop-de-doops, and he did. He keeps fixing me with these weird stares, then bursting into laughter. Lou starts talking about reading Raymond Chandler. Now, I'm on firm ground here, having read his entire works recently. I interrupt him at one point, saying enthusiastically, "I know that bit, it's great, but it's not from The Little Sister, it's from The High Window." Lou stares at me.
Hey, Danny. She's talking. Do you let her talk?
Danny smiles and says,
She does as she likes.
Lou goes on with his Chandler story. Even though I've been chastened for participating in Lou's diatribe, I can't help but jump back in a second time with some pertinent detail about how Chandler lifted something from Hammett. Again, Lou glares at me.
Danny, she's doing it again. What is she, a big reader?
She's a very talented art student. She has a mind of her own.
Where did you pick up this one? Lou asked Danny.
I found her at the Waldorf. She's the talk of the town. Everyone's after her.
All right. So they like to talk about me in the third person like I'm not there. Plus, I'm a she now. Must be a Max's thing. I'm thinking, this is their turf, and these are their weird rules. It is humiliating, true, but I let it roll off. Big deal.
Danny gets up to get us some Gulwaz filters. Lou says,
Well, Rathbone, do you have a curfew tonight?
No.
Well, where do you go then?
Home.
To spend the night?
Uh-huh.
Do you belong to Danny?
No, Danny's my friend.
So you're just friends with Danny. He's my friend, too. You know, you look like David Cassidy. Do you like David Cassidy?
No.
No?
I do.
You could be my David Cassidy. How would you like that?
I wouldn't.
I tell you what. I got a hotel room tonight, and we could go back there, and you could be my little David Cassidy. How about that?
Uh-uh.
He leans into my ear and whispers, You could shit in my mouth. Would you like that?
No.
Okay, then. How's this? I'll put a plate over my face, and you can shit on that, and then I'll eat it. How would that be?
I wouldn't like that either, I answered in a monotone.
I'm disgusted, which I presume was the point. My hero worship is immediately over.
Ick.
He stares at me a long while and says, You'll be missing me tonight. Got a split. He downs the rest of his tequila and leaves me alone in the booth to ponder my missed scatological opportunity.
Danny eventually returns, excited.
Lou's in love with you.
How do you know? I say sullenly.
He told me in the men's room.
Yeah, and you know what he wanted me to do?
Shit in his mouth, I said, making a face.
Oh, didn't you want to? Says Danny, all concerned.
No! What is it with you people?
Last night, I saw Visconti's The Damned. Helmut Berger played an elegant, androgynous, incestuous, sadistic, druggy, alcoholic Nazi. Beautiful Charlotte Rampling was his sister, playing doctor under the piano. Sick, but riveting. In the lobby, I saw Antonio Lopez model Donna Jordan, very slight and blonde and beautiful and gap-toothed.
Sigh.
Party at Cherry Vanilla's. She is Bowie's publicist, Chelsea Abode, for a telecast of Bowie's 1980 floor show, filmed at the Marquee Club. Her large apartment is Bowie land. Bowie dolls, Bowie paintings, enormous Bowie photos, Bowie collages spliced with tasteful tinted porno, the walls painted as a blue sky with powdery airbrushed clouds. I snoop in the bedroom, made infinite by mirrored tiles, a pink chiffon canopy over the bed, which I sat on to watch a tape that's on of Angie Bowie and The Tonight Show. Carson asks her, What is it like being married to a rock star with all the girls after him? Angie replies, Honey, what about the boys? We pick up a lot of slough.
A very tall, emaciated woman in black with exotic eyes entered the room and stood right in front of the TV screen I was watching. So I swatted her on the ass. She whirled around and slapped me full across the cheek. Then she squatted down to my sitting position, put her arms around my neck, and said in a foreign accent, "Darling, are we fighting already? We've only just begun," and kissed me on the mouth. I was somewhat terrified. She laughed at my naivete and joined the rest of the party. I then remembered her from interview. "Cheyenne?" Party is in full swing. Big fat Tony Ingracia, who is working on Bowie's stage production of Orwell's 1984, never left the snack table. Sarinda Fox in black suit next to Lee, who is going on about how New York City will fall in 2 years, so he is here to capture the dying embers of an affluent, bored, transsexual madness on film. Like the fall of the Roman Empire. Two cuties from Main Man, Teresa and Buxom Dory, sit on the couch cutting paper dolls and sewing Christmas stockings. Interview photographer Christopher Makos is looking a bit like one of Robin Hood's men, with his faint beard and bondage getup. He is rumored to be kept by Tony Perkins. Jamie Andrews got a new perm, looks like Harpo now, calls me Dunkin' Donuts, pours me drinks. Couple of faux Bardots tarred around. Tall, handsome Stephen Demarest, a dead ringer for Richard Chamberlain, has got all the girls in a tizzy. Bowie came on at 12:30, and all the people who worked for him went crazy. The Trogs had opened with their Wild Thing, and the MC was Verushka. She introduced Marianne Faithfull and said, "Very strange," after each number. Bowie's best was The Mercy's Sorrow, done as a chess game in black and white. The girls screamed over Mick Ronson, the psychedelic surfer from Hull. The show was unlike anything I'd ever seen before, very modern and risque. At 2:30 a.m., Danny and I hopped into Steve Paul's limo, bound for his estate in Greenwich, Connecticut, that used to belong to Rita Hayworth. Over the door is a brass plaque that says, "The House That Frankenstein Bought," alluding to the Edgar Winter hit song that Steve guided to number one on the hit parade. He made a bundle. Danny made pancakes for me and Steve. We pretended we were starving orphans, begging from door to door. At 6 a.m., we went out to the Chilly Dawn Chorus, walking by the stable, the pool, the ghostly gazebo, and the empty tennis courts, our boots crunching on the November ground as we strode past granite sculptures of Cupid, the shock of nature. Saturday, Danny took 600 pictures of me, by the pond, in the sun porch next to the ferns, and in the spacious stone living room, which was equipped with a high-beamed ceiling, suits of armor, and George Gershwin's grand piano. More like the set of an English horror movie than the weekend getaway of a rock and roll businessman. Black-tiled bathrooms with floor-to-ceiling mirrors, discarded copies of the new musical Express by the toilet. Danny looks through the shutter and says, "Think of something sad." Click. New lens. Click. New role. Click. Give me more. Click. Fantastic. Click. Okay, that's good, but really give it to me. Click. Okay, you just lost your lover. Click. Moisten your lips. Click. Hold it. Click. Pull your legs up. Click. Great. Click. 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 All day long. Exhausting. I watched The Avengers and took a nap. Dinner in the kitchen at a long glass table. First course, hashish and artichokes. Then roast beef and cauliflower, listening to classical music and show tunes. Brandy and ginger ales. Steve says, "Turn on the TV, there's an old Duncan Hannah movie on." I went to bed to read Colette. Eric and I went to the Academy of Music to see Hawkwind, who weren't to my taste, but the after-party at the Hayden Planetarium was great. Talked with Peter Lester, English gossip columnist.